than 25 years.
Good afternoon. It's midday. I'm Mike Mulcahy, sitting in for Gary Eichten. The Summit on Minnesota's Economy, hosted by the University of Minnesota, is underway at the River Center in downtown St. Paul. Summit participants are spending their day listening to speakers discuss Minnesota's position in the global economy and participating in a forum addressing Minnesota's economic future. This hour, we'll hear remarks from University of Minnesota President Mark Udoff and the opening keynote addresses from the summit earlier this morning, including remarks from Governor Jesse Ventura and Wall Street Journal Washington Bureau Chief Alan Murray. To start, here's University of Minnesota President Mark Udoff.
Now, to keep things in perspective today, I'd offer a saying in Yiddish. This is the saying is "Menken Chach an Gut Lach," which, for those few among you who don't speak Yiddish, says "People plan and God laughs." And that may be true, but Minnesotans are planners, and we don't want to stumble over the future. And besides, I hope we're on at least passable term with God so that we can make this happen. This summit is part of an effort to establish a longer-term trajectory for the state. This is not about creating an industrial policy for Minnesota. Rather, I believe, is about trying to tweak the public policy solutions and private sector innovations that we in Minnesotans know so well. If the state were an airplane in the sky, I think we'd be looking at making gentle adjustments to the rudder, not lurches one way or the other, making incremental changes by degrees that may change our course over a decade, rather than jamming down the wing flaps and climbing at an unpleasant speed and with much danger. I think what many of us are looking for today are both real and symbolic changes that will head us in the direction we want the state to go. In some ways, we're looking for a tipping point, and tipping points are very important. The idea of a tipping point is that relatively modest changes in policy, attitudes, or perceptions can tip the scales dramatically one way or the other. That is, they will have profound effects over time. So in other words, when things go a little bit badly, as in a neighborhood where windows are broken and remain unfixed, or the trash is not removed, or there's more petty crime, things can get a lot worse very quickly because of a downward spiral and more crime and making the neighbors more fearful of being out on the streets. By the same token, a tip in the opposite direction, with enforcement of petty crime laws, fresh paint, promptly fixed windows, can lead to neighborhood stabilization and a spiral in exactly the other direction, even though each and every one of those changes was relatively small, relatively modest. So I believe that what we're thinking about here today, at least what I think about, is can we begin to have this tipping point? Can we reach the point where we haven't broken the budget and we haven't done anything strange or weird or doesn't fit with Minnesota's character, but it's a tipping point. That Minnesota is viewed as friendly to business. It is friendly to entrepreneurs. It has the necessary research at the university. It has the necessary intellectual underpinnings. So the people around the country, and I think this is a message of many of the governor's visits, can say Minnesota is a good place to be. And they'll be referring not only to our high quality of life, but it is a dynamic environment in which to run and businesses and in which to work and so forth. Having said that, of course, we have to be true to Minnesota's roots and with a need to reward innovation and with a need for fairness. And as our friends in labor and in communities of color will tell you, spurring economic growth that leaves behind part of our population simply will not fly here. And as our friends on the business side will tell you, Minnesota is facing a severe shortage of workers in many areas. Clearly, the call for greater participation in this booming economy and the need for skilled workers are two sides of the same coin. That is, a ladder to the unemployed or to the underemployed is also a ladder which takes you to a more vibrant economic future for the entire state. I think we'd be hard-pressed to start this discussion from a better point in time as far as our economy goes, or with a better historical legacy of education, statesmanlike leaders, high-quality health care, and innovative human services than we have presently in Minnesota. I've learned that quality of life is something Minnesotans take very seriously and hold dearly, and is reflected in many rankings. For example, our per capita income has increased from 16th among the states to 10th. And by all measures, our economy is very diversified. For a record fourth consecutive year, Minnesota has been ranked the most livable state in the union by state rankings based on 43 factors ranging from median household income to crime rate to infant mortality rates. Our city of Rochester was mentioned by the Milken Report as one of the top high-tech polls by virtue of its concentration of technology, the presence of Mayo, and so forth. Our state students also rank consistently high on national education assessments, and there are other indicators of how well we're doing. In less qualitative terms, we are known for a strong work ethic. That is important. And something that really appeals to me about Minnesota, political science Robert Putnam in his book Bowling Alone has been explaining the decline in social capital in America, civic participation, not writing letters, not voting, not reading the newspapers, not participating in clubs, and so forth. And this is an issue the governor has spoken out on, particularly on the voting side of the issue. But Minnesota is always at the top of the charts. Minnesota demonstrably has more social capital than any state in the United States, with occasionally North Dakota, for reasons I don't understand, sneaking ahead of us and a few of these indicators. But basically, we have better social networks, more cooperation, more civic engagement. And if you read this book, all those things are good for the economy, they're good for children, they're good for human health, they're good for reducing crime, they're good for so many things. That's remarkable, I think, for a state like ours. And what's even more remarkable is we are 4.8 million people in a global bucket of 6 billion people. We don't pump iron from the ground or benefit from being located on the coast, as Chuck said, but in some ways we are perfectly situated to take advantage of the new knowledge economy. We have been living by our wits, by our acumen, by our pragmatism for a very long period of time, and it's that brain power, by and large, that has made up for the shortfall of some of those natural resources. In other ways, there are other indicators that should trigger concern or at least lead us to ask questions about the future. We have underemployment of incumbent workers. We have high dropout rates in some school districts. We have economic hardships faced by some in greater Minnesota and in our urban areas, and particularly in some of our communities of color. Those are areas for concern. It is for these reasons that I've called on the remarkable organizers and speakers and participants today to come together, and in a relatively short time, I might add, to take on these heavy issues. And I also know as a new time Minnesota, that it would be pointless to hold this kind of forum midsummer when so many people are up at the lake and in their cabins. As the president of the state's largest research institution, a university that contributes 10,000 graduates a year, I am keenly aware that the University of Minnesota is not the only convener of this summit. It is also a rather large stakeholder. Some have said that by calling for this summit, I am, as president, acting a little bit self-interestedly. And I said from day one, what do you mean by a little? It's a lot. And as will be clear throughout today, we are self-interested, we are very interested, but we are one of many, many important stakeholders who are gathered here, and I think we have to be very careful and we'll try to define our roles appropriate. To conclude, I look forward to the deliberations today as we examine the best for our future as a state. We may see some ideas drop off during our discussions here while others merge and rise to the top. We may also see policy solutions that are most appropriate for the state to take on. We may see others that are wholly appropriate for the private sector to take on, and indeed we may see areas where partnerships between the public and the private sector make the most sense. It will be a lot easier to move forward, I think, even with very modest proposals, if we're facing in the same direction, if we're pulling in the same direction, if we're proceeding, hopefully, by consensus and with the great type of leadership that we have in our governor and in our legislature. Thank you very much.
University of Minnesota President Mark Udoff. The university is hosting today's summit on Minnesota's economy, which is underway at River Center in downtown St. Paul. Governor Jesse Ventura was invited to give a morning keynote address. Here's that speech.
Before I go to my prepared remarks, I'd just like to say that yesterday our economy in Minnesota got two big boosts. First of all, trade with China was passed by the U.S. Senate. And second of all, our gold reserve just went up thanks to Tommy Malchow. You know, President Udoff, our jobs are similar in many ways. We are both charged with making Minnesota a leader among peers. We understand that the people of Minnesota expect the university and state government to work together, building public policy foundations upon which our citizens can live and work. Our jobs are interrelated, and the institutions that we lead are codependent. We both understand that a healthy University of Minnesota contributes to a healthy Minnesota economy. And finally, President Udoff and I understand how important it is to help Minnesota leaders agree on a path for making Minnesota successful in the future. And that's what we're here today to talk about. For your efforts in convening this summit, President Udoff, I would like to say thank you very, very much. You know, someone once asked Yogi Berra, if there were a fork in the road, what would he do? Take it, Yogi said. It seems to me that as we travel down the economic highway these days, we can't be ambivalent when we come to a fork in the road. Indecision is a leading cause of accidents, and we cannot afford accidents on our way to a new economy. Like Yogi, we must be decisive. We must have a plan, and optimally, the private sector, state government, and our academic institutions will work off this same plan. First, let's agree on one thing. Minnesota, simply said, is where it's at. I'm a big fan of Minnesota. I tout our quality of life, our beautiful amenities, and our bright, hardworking people everywhere that I go. As the president indicated a little bit earlier, for the fourth year in a row, Minnesota was ranked the most livable state in the country by an independent research company. This ranking was based on such qualities as health, income, housing, education, and recreational facilities. Minnesota spawned the medical device industry, thanks to some impressive research feats and a strong university. Minnesota is the home to hundreds, literally, of inventions, including Post-it notes. Where would we be today without those little notes that you can stick on your desk to remind you what you need to do the rest of the day? Rollerblades. And, of course, Wheaties. The Twin Cities area ranks first in the nation in the percentage of adults with high school diplomas and fifth in the nation with the percentage of adults with college degrees. The Twin Cities are home to 13 Fortune 500 companies, and World Trade Magazine recently called Minneapolis the second best in the nation for international business. There is much to be proud of. Our lives and our economy are full. Why? Three reasons come to mind. our entrepreneurial spirit, ooh, there's a word, our diverse economy, and the resilience of our people. You know, I consider myself an entrepreneur, but I am just one among many in the state of Minnesota. We have a great spirit and a rich history of entrepreneurship in Minnesota. That spirit has led to some impressive historic feats, including performing the first open heart surgery, inventing the cardiac pacemaker, developing the taconite mining process, and believe it or not, we even invented water skiing. Minnesota is home to key industries like agribusiness, medical technology, telecommunications, and a growing travel and tourism industry. We build boats and bake bread and write books. We mine ore. We make sugar. Our economy is diverse, and indeed it is strong. Strong because it is supported by a resilient workforce. This is a great state. But we are not here today to rest on our laurels. We are here to build on them. We are here to prepare for the next phase of this new economy. And what is this new economy? Well, I would describe it as an old economy with a rebuilt foundation. And that foundation is built on technology, globalization, and a highly skilled, highly motivated workforce. I speak of this new economy with some experience. Let me share with you for a moment some of that experience. 20 months ago, I began to govern this state, and together with an excellent staff and a very smart cabinet, I began to think about our future and how we should go about preparing for it. I told my commissioners, when you think about the future, don't think 1 year or 5 years ahead down the road. Think 20 years into the future. And together, that's what we did. And we came up with a plan. Of course, it just wasn't any old plan. It was the big plan. We started with a strategic vision for healthy, vital communities. Looking ahead, we asked, what can the state do today to ensure that Minnesota's communities are healthy and vital tomorrow? One answer we came up with was infrastructure. And we started with infrastructure in the form of accountable public education system, with highly motivated administrators, teachers, and parents, all of whom work hard to graduate high-achieving students that will be the workforce of the future. And we aren't just talking about it. Last year, we delivered new money to schools for smaller class sizes in grades K through 3, and the first increase in the basic per pupil formula in well over a decade. This year, we held firm in our belief that we must have standards and that we worked with the legislature to improve our graduation standards. And next year, we're going to ask the legislature to work with us to make sure that our public education system is paid for through a fair and equitable tax system. These are real reforms that are absolutely necessary to help build a workforce foundation for this new economy. Today, Minnesota businesses are spending $2 billion to train, develop, and keep their own workers. The state spends another $100 million on job training, dislocated worker programs, and workforce centers. My workforce development mini cabinet has a plan on the table. That plan's focus is to give Minnesota's workers a, quote, leg up. It redirects current resources to increase the skills of the 40% of our workforce who make less than $10 an hour. We need the business community not only to invest in Minnesota's workforce, but to come to the table with ideas on how to bring workers into the new economy and how to keep highly skilled and highly educated workers here. Join us, business leaders and academic leaders, to finish the job and bring a reform workforce agenda to the legislature this year. Another important element of the big plan focuses on our transportation system. Yes, last year we got a light rail line that was an important start, but it is a mere drop in the bucket when it comes to what we truly need. We need a comprehensive multimodal transportation system for the entire state of Minnesota. Perhaps you will recall that this year I had a bill that would have created that system. It was a bill with a vision for the long term. It was a bill that created a permanent funding stream for transportation projects in all of Minnesota. But it went nowhere. Why? Because we didn't work together. We let the forces of politics defeat us. If we learn anything today, I hope it is that when we have a chance to advance good public policy, we cannot afford to have anyone on the sidelines. Not business, not labor, and not the university. We all need to pay attention, and we all need to work together. But we do learn, and I am confident that in the future, we will work together. Because when we do, believe me, good things happen. Good things like our big plan initiative that was successful in investing over $170 million additional dollars in affordable housing. Housing that is desperately needed for the new economy workforce. When I talk about healthy, vital communities as governor of Minnesota, I'm talking about both inside and outside the seven-county metro area. As my cabinet and I have worked to improve the competitive position of rural Minnesota, we've quickly come to realize that it's not just about agriculture. While agriculture is still the mainstay of the rural economy in much of Minnesota, it is not the force that it once was. These times are changing, and Main Street Minnesota is about a diverse rural economy. It's a tough message that isn't easy for some to hear, but I have a responsibility to look into the future and to prepare Minnesota communities for the tough realities. If we're going to keep small town rural Minnesota healthy, we need to stop throwing money at just one sector and start looking at communities as a whole. The big plan looks at a rural Minnesota with a little different vision, a vision that recognizes a very balanced approach. Business development, workforce development, telecommunications technology, housing, transportation, and yes, of course, agriculture are going to make rural Minnesota's economy and communities vital. But technology is huge. By every measure, the new economy is greatly influenced by technology and telecommunications. It is very interesting to note that of the 29 specific initiatives that have evolved out of the big plan, 17 are dependent on the information technology. Technology is a key factor in keeping citizens in touch with their government, wherever they may live in the state of Minnesota. And technology plays a huge, very large role in keeping our business and industry competitive in today's global economy. In fact, in public remarks made last year, Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan credited, quote, newer technologies with making capital investment and productivity more profitable. In these newer technologies that will keep our taconite mining industry viable and our farmers competitive in the new economy. My telecommunications reform bill is on the table this year, was on the table this year at the legislature, and it is absolutely critical that we all work together to get it through the legislature. Another big plan initiative, and I alluded to this earlier, is my recently announced plan to reform our tax system. Sitting in this room, you are some of the smartest people in all of Minnesota. But it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that our tax system is one that was built around the old economy. We need a tax system that is simple and fair. But more than anything, we need a tax system that is aligned with the reality and the demands of a global competitive marketplace. In 1929, 60% of personal expenditures were for goods, and the remaining 40% were for services. By 1999, those percents are today nearly reversed. 40% for goods, 60% for services. Realigning our tax system to recognize the new era of service requires some hard choices. My tax reform agenda at the legislature this year will recognize that citizens and business want accountability government that is fair and helps them live and do business in this new economy. You've heard me say before, look, no strings. It's true. I want government to be an open book. Every citizen should be able to read their tax statement, apply for electronic government services with ease, and most importantly, vote without hassle. Another important element of our big plan is trade. Our mantra should be, it's the global economy, stupid. The goal of our state policies should be to make individuals and firms more competitive in the world economy. Since I became governor, I have worked tirelessly to promote Minnesota and Minnesota products, not only across the country, but around the world. I assure you, I will continue to do so. A new economy requires a new mindset. As business people and academics know, expanding markets mean expanding sales, expanding jobs, and higher wages. In years to come, the face of Minnesota's economy will certainly look different than it does today, in part because of new immigrant populations springing up not just in the metro area, but in rural towns throughout the state. My working group on minority business development has developed a plan on how to make minority communities thrive in Minnesota. One of their suggestions was to figure out how to tap new immigrant communities and channel the entrepreneurial energy and bolster Minnesota's economy. What an exciting challenge this will be. President Udoff, again, I appreciate your leadership today in bringing leaders together to talk about Minnesota's challenges. Now, let me challenge you. I challenge you today to look at the role of the University of Minnesota and how the U can contribute to our economic vitality. 50 years ago, a land-grant university had the responsibility to show farmers how to rotate the crops and use the latest plow. In today's economy, I believe that role has changed into a technology role. What about the new ideas coming out of the university? Are there some changes that, with your leadership, could help the university reach out while businesses reach in to better connect ideas to the marketplace? I vow to explore how to help make this happen, but the state government can't do commercialization alone. We need buy-in from the business community, and we need a university culture that fosters entrepreneurship. Are you with us? Can we count on you? For my part as governor, I'm going to continue to be a fan of Minnesota's economy, and I will tout that to do business around the and I will tout that to businesses around the country everywhere that I go. I will continue to be an advocate for the University of Minnesota, because a healthy university can greatly contribute to a healthy Minnesota economy. And I will continue to push for my big plan initiatives that get the job done for Minnesota: tax reform, education reform, telecommunications reform, workforce development, the commercialization of new discoveries, and all the other big plan initiatives that result in a strong economy for Minnesota. As I continue this work, I ask you, do I stand alone? From the looks of today, I happily say I believe that answer is no. I believe that Minnesota business community, President Udoff, and most importantly, the citizens of Minnesota who get up and go to work every day, will ensure that Minnesota's economy does not fall behind. If we work together, I do not believe we will have reason for alarm. But at this point, it would serve us all better if we got behind one strategy, one plan that lays out the future of Minnesota. Let's come to the legislature as one voice, the voice in favor of Minnesota, a voice that says we need targeted, reallocated investments with clearly articulated results in opening markets, workforce development, education, transportation, and commercialization of new discoveries. A voice that says we can't let hard decisions surrounding tax reform, telecommunications reform, and workforce development languish for another year. And finally, we need a dose of common sense and an acceptance of a common vision that says Minnesota will still be a leader if we work together. Today is a good day to start. Together, let's take the fork in the road to the 21st century and the new economy. Thank you very, very much.
Governor Jesse Ventura speaking this morning at the Summit on Minnesota's Economy. The other keynote speaker was Alan Murray, Washington bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. He's also the author of the book, The Wealth of Choices. Murray spoke about the impact of politics and technological advances on America's economy. Here's an excerpt from Alan Murray's remarks.
I believe we are living through the most profound period of economic change probably of the last century, since the Industrial Revolution in the late 1800s. And it is changing everything. It is changing the way our economy functions. It is changing the way we relate to each other. It is changing the way we deal with questions of education, of health care, all the things in our lives that involve money. And I think it's quite clear, you know, up until fairly recently, you still had people who would debate the question, is there or isn't there a new economy? Well, I think that debate is over. I think it's quite clear that there's something profoundly different going on. I wrote a column on the front page of the Wall Street Journal 4 years ago, before the last election, that whoever won that election, whether it was Dole or Clinton, whoever won was going to have to deal with a recession. I said that because we had never gone through a 9-year period in the history of this country where you didn't have a recession. But now we have. 5 years ago, every major macro economist you could find, regardless of their political stripes, would tell you that you couldn't get unemployment below 6% without sparking inflation. Well, here we are at 4% in this state, less than 4%. We've been there for a couple of years now. No sign of an increase inflation. In fact, if anything, at least until the recent oil price rise, inflation seemed to be headed the other way. That is a big, big difference. 4 or 5 years ago, it was taken as accepted wisdom that the productivity growth rate in this country that we had seen, the disappointing productivity growth rate that we had seen in the 1970s and that we had seen, late 1970s, in the 1980s and in the 1990s would continue into the next century. Now what we're looking at is an expectation that the much faster productivity growth rates that we had in the 50s and 60s are back, possibly even something greater than that. And, of course, that has enormous effects on the ability of living standards to rise. So clearly something very, very different is going on, and I believe it's just beginning, that we haven't seen the full impact of this. Now, what does that mean? What does that mean to Minnesota? Well, let me start, first of all, by saying what it doesn't mean. One of the canards out there. Let me burst a myth, because you hear a lot from the prophets of the new economy, the prophets of the Internet, that the Internet has obliterated distance. The Internet means geography is no longer important. Doesn't matter where you are, anywhere you are, if you have a modem and a telephone line, you can plug in and be part of the great global cyberspace economy. And obviously there's some truth to that. I mean, you can read the stories about the craftsmen in Tanzania who have seen their sales increase a thousandfold because of their ability to market their crafts over the Internet. Certainly a state like Minnesota, which has suffered over the centuries because of its position in the middle of a giant landmass, now finds that that's not nearly the problem that it once was, because the things of value that we're talking about don't have to travel down the Mississippi River or across the landmass. They can travel over fiber optic lines. There are significant changes, but it also seems clear, if you look at this really closely, that in some ways, in this knowledge economy, place has become more important. I mean, it is not a coincidence that the driving engines of the new economy are happening in very particular places. Silicon Valley, Redmond, Washington, Route 128, Northern Virginia, Austin, Texas, some of the best work on this subject has been done by Michael Porter at the Harvard Business School, and what he shows is that in these economies where ideas are so important, the ability to have a constant informal exchange of ideas, the kind of thing that goes on over lunch or over the squash court, or the kind of thing that just happens because you see the guy down the street striking something good, doing something successful, and it makes you want to do it more yourself. And so the ability to have sort of a critical mass of people who are thinking about the same kinds of things and working on the same kinds of things and developing the same kind of things, contrary to what some Internet philosophers will tell you, is actually more important today than it was before, more important today than it has been. So I think what you're doing here today in Minnesota, which is talking about how can you create a place that allows this new economy to flourish, is very important. Now, how can you do that? What are the important factors here? Well, one of the things I found working on the book, and many of you, I think, probably understand this better than I do, is that we've lived through periods of history when the ownership of land was the important source of power. We've lived through periods of history when the ownership of oil, energy in its various forms, was the important source of dynamism and power in the economy. We've lived through periods when control of capital was the important thing. It was the people who had the money who were able to create the projects that worked. But today, more than ever before, it's knowledge, it's ideas. It is the single, supple, well-trained, imaginative human mind that is the source of power. And the other things will come to it, including the money, by the way. I know you're going to talk a lot about venture capital today, and there may be things that the state can do to encourage venture capital. But my sense right now is there is enough money that good projects get funded wherever they are. It might be a little bit easier to get a bad project funded in Silicon Valley, but good projects get funded because there is a lot of money out there chasing not enough good ideas. So even the money will come to the ideas. And, you know, just to put this in historical perspective for a second, it's interesting to think all the science fiction fantasies that we have had over the years about how technology was going to be dehumanizing. Going back to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, movies like Fahrenheit 451, books like Brave New World or 1984, all suggested that technology was somehow going to diminish the value of the individual human. And isn't it great here at the turn of a new century to find just the opposite is true, that what technology has done has raised the value of the single human mind far higher than any of us would ever have imagined, even 10 years ago. So that is, it seems to me, that is clearly the key to this economy. And that is clearly the first, needs to be the first focus of anything you do here. And that, of course, means education, 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 education. Developing a strong university system, developing a strong K through 12 system. I mean, this isn't theory on my part. There are hard facts here. If you look, for instance, at the average earnings of an American woman today, average earnings of an American woman with a college degree are double the average earnings of a woman with just a high school degree. That's the biggest gap that we have ever seen. It makes a huge difference. It makes a huge, huge difference. And of course, education is becoming a much more flexible concept. It doesn't, college degree, the equivalent of a college degree, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to come from 4 years spent at the university campus. We're finding different ways to deliver education. The community colleges in this country have become increasingly important and powerful in working with businesses and figuring out how to provide the kinds of skills and training and education that enable people to take better advantage of the workplace opportunities in the new economy. It is interesting to me that at this time of exploding productivity in every other industry, that what Governor Ventura is talking about, what President Clinton is talking about, is decreasing the productivity of K through 12 teachers, reducing the class size, deleveraging the power of a single teacher to reach more students. I can't help but believe when I look at how technology, email in particular, technology more broadly, has expanded my ability to deal with a bureau of 45 people. I can't believe that at some point we aren't going to figure out how to use technology and software to enable really good teachers to work with larger groups of students, to have software programs that allow each student to progress at their own pace but provide for not less interaction with the teacher, but more interaction for the teacher. That's what technology is all about. And it hasn't, that way of thinking hasn't quite gotten to the educators yet. I have this argument with the headmaster of the elementary school my two girls are in. It's a little Episcopal day school. And he will swear to me that 50 years from now, elementary education will look just like it does today, where you have about 20 kids sitting in a classroom with one teacher. I can't believe that is true or should be true. I think we just haven't gotten to the point where we can figure out how to use really good software, really good technology to increase the productivity of our great teachers. That'll enable us to pay them more. That'll enable them to educate larger groups of kids, and that has to be a good thing. So again, if there are things you can do in that area, it's important. And then the one other thing that I would, you have speakers coming along the rest of the day who understand Minnesota and Minnesota's challenges far, far better than I do. But the one other thing I would emphasize is that there seems to be some real value when you understand what the driving force is, when you understand the importance of the exchange of ideas and this critical mass of smart, educated people thinking about the same kinds of things, there seems to be a real value in developing your strengths, in building business clusters. Medical devices is obviously a strength of this area. Well, I don't know how much those people, whether those people are located within geographical proximity of each other, whether they get together frequently, but boy, that's a powerful industry, an industry that's going to grow in the future, and whatever you can do to develop that, you should. Biotechnology, particularly biotechnology with respect to agriculture, again, a place where this state ought to have an edge, and sort of focusing on those areas where you already have strengths and developing those would seem to be the way to mimic what's happened in Northern Virginia, in my area, in Silicon Valley, in Austin, in Route 128. So I would leave those thoughts with you. Let me, before I go, say a few words about what's happening in Washington or what will be happening in Washington with regard to all of these issues, because I think there's another misperception out there, a misperception that I might have shared a couple of years ago, and that is that we live in a world where Washington is less and the national government is less and less important to our lives, and the important things are either happening locally or they're happening internationally. And in fact, it's become increasingly clear in the last year, there are a host of really big issues heading towards Washington that can only be solved at the national level and will have to be addressed in the next few years, and that, in my view, make this election probably the most important election that I've ever watched. It's turned into an awfully interesting election, too, by the way. I think at the beginning of the year, a lot of people thought, Al Gore, George W. Bush. Al Gore is the guy who's known as the inspiration to Americans who suffer from Dutch elm disease. George Bush is saying, vote for me or I'll tell my daddy. This isn't much fun. But what we've got, in fact, is an election that is incredibly close. The latest polling we've done at the Wall Street Journal shows that if you go with registered voters, Al Gore has about a 3-point lead. But if you then say, okay, are you likely to vote in November, and only count those people who say they're likely to vote, the lead switches to George Bush to about 2 percentage points. So I think that shows you that we are talking about right now a head-on race. So it's become a very interesting race. The stakes are high in part because I think whoever wins the race will very likely carry the House of Representatives with him. And with that goes all the power that goes with controlling the leadership jobs and the major committee chairmanships. But most of all, it is an important and interesting race to me because you see these huge issues, some of them not even being talked about in the campaign, that are going to have to be sorted out by this next government. The biggest, of course, is the budget surplus, which is a creation of the new economy. I mean, yes, the President and Congress, and for that matter, the Bush administration, deserve credit for the deficit reduction efforts they have made over the last decade. But the biggest reason why we are looking at a pot of possibly $4 trillion building up over the next decade is because of what's happening in the economy, because we now believe that the productivity increases we've seen in the last 5 years can sustain themselves for some time because of this technological revolution. So the surpluses are created by the new economy. So so I think the new economy is presenting a huge number of issues that will have to be sorted out in Washington. I say they have to be sorted out in Washington because there is no one on the international level that can begin to deal with issues of that complexity. I mean, we can't do anything much in our international institutions, and you can't deal with them at the local level. You can't deal with issues like privacy at the local level because you can't ask people doing business on the internet to adhere to thousands of different local policies or even 50 different state policies. Taxation is another one. We can no longer have 50, if we're going to collect retail sales taxes, we cannot have 50 different sales tax regimes. We will have to standardize sales taxes so that it can be collected over the internet. So so I think it's going to be a very, very interesting election to watch. And let me just say one final word, because you can't ask questions, but if you could ask questions, I know somebody out there would ask me this, they always do. If you could ask questions, you would say, who do I think is going to win the election? And the real answer is, I don't have a clue. And I'm going to give you another answer anyway, though, because I know you want it. I don't have a clue. I think it's awfully close. I think either one of these guys could win. But if you held my feet to the fire, if you put bamboo under my fingernails and said, you have to say one name, I would say Al Gore. And the reason I'd say Al Gore is because of Richard Hatch. How many of you know who Richard Hatch is? You folks are really out of touch. Richard Hatch is the guy who won Survivor. Come on. Come on. I mean, in most audiences in America, more people know who Richard Hatch is than know who Al Gore is. Jeez. And I don't mean to suggest, let me make it clear, I do not mean to suggest that Al Gore is an overweight homosexual nudist. That is not what I'm suggesting. But if you watched any of that, what you learned was that Richard Hatch was tougher than the other people there, he was meaner than the other people there, and he wanted it more than the other guy, and he won. And that's why, if you put my feet to the fire, I'd say Al Gore probably has the best chances of winning.
Alan Murray, Washington Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal and author of the book The Wealth of Choices. He spoke this morning at the Summit on Minnesota's Economy, which was hosted by the University of Minnesota. And that's Midday for today. If you missed this or any of the past week's Midday programs, you can visit our website, www.minnesotapublicradio.org. And a reminder about tomorrow's program. At noon, we'll have a speech from the Westminster Town Hall Forum, a speech by Dr. Christine Castle on aging. And then coming up on Friday, a very interesting program, two prominent national politicians. In the first hour, it'll be former Senator Eugene McCarthy in the studio with Gary Ikton. And at noon on Friday, Ralph Nader, the Green Party candidate for president, taking your calls.
On Sound Money this week, we hear from the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. It's the place to go when you're over your head in debt. Learn more on Sound Money Saturday morning at 10, again Sunday afternoon at 5 on Minnesota Public Radio, KNOW-FM 91.1.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio. It's cloudy and 55 degrees at KNOW-FM 91.1, Minneapolis, St. Paul. Twin Cities weather for today, cloudy, 50% chance for showers this afternoon, high in just the mid to upper 50s, so I guess we're already there. Tonight, it'll clear up eventually, a low around 38 degrees. Tomorrow, cloudy, high again in the 50s.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Juan Williams, and this is Talk of the Nation. What has NBC done to the Olympics? Television ratings are down, and many TV critics say the problem is NBC's overdone dramatization of every athlete's life. Here is satirist Harry Shearer.
Whether your name is Tiffany or Wei Jingzhou, there's no avoiding the obvious. Once the competition begins, triumph or heartbreak is only a heartbeat away. For her, losing has been a